Okay, let's unpack this. We are diving into a realm that, well, almost everyone, regardless of their political affiliation or economic view, considers fixed, permanent, utterly untouchable. We're talking about the foundation of the U.S. monetary system itself. We're talking about the Federal Reserve.
And for over a century, the Federal Reserve has been the central pillar, not just of American finance, but you could argue of the entire global financial structure.
Absolutely.
Yet, the source material we are dissecting today, it doesn't just critique its policies. It launches a profound legal and constitutional indictment. The argument suggests that this entire pillar is structurally unsound.
How unsound?
That it is analytically void ab initio.
Void ab initio. Okay, that sounds like something from an ancient Latin spellbook, but it's a critical legal concept. We really need to be very clear about what that means.
That phrase is the entire mission of this deep dive. Void ab initio means void from the very beginning. A complete legal nullity.
A nullity.
Yeah. Imagine you purchase a beautiful home, you've lived in it for years, only to discover the original deed was a complete fraud because the seller never actually owned the land.
Right.
Your title isn't just invalid, it's void from inception. It never existed.
So all the transactions that came after are built on nothing.
Exactly. The source material we're working from, an article titled The Federal Reserve System, a constitutional indictment, void ab initio, published in the Government Accountability Commission Law Review, argues that the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 carries this exact defect.
That is a staggering claim. I mean, it's not focused on whether interest rates should be higher or lower or, you know, whether the Fed handled the last recession well.
No, this is not a policy debate.
The critique is purely structural. Our goal here is not to debate that policy or to endorse the source's conclusion, but really to explore its detailed legal and constitutional history. We have to understand how something so entrenched could potentially lack legal foundation under its own written law.
Which means we have to start right at the top.
Where's that?
With the foundational architecture of constitutionalism itself. Hashtag 1.0, setting the foundational constitutional architecture. Precisely. To understand the limits of government, you first have to establish the legal hierarchy that came before the government.
Before? Okay.
The premise of the source, and really a foundational American thought, is that law preceded government. Government is a creation of law, not the other way around.
And they root this, surprisingly, in the Declaration of Independence, not the Constitution.
Correct. The founders cited the laws of nature and of nature's God. This natural law is considered supreme. It's immutable, and it's coeval with mankind. It's the highest source of authority, setting the ethical and structural boundaries for all subsequent human laws.
So it's the idea that certain universal principles of right and wrong exist, you know, independent of any legislature.
Yes. And this wasn't just philosophical window dressing. It was treated as binding law by legal giants. The source leans very heavily on William Blackstone, the authority on English common law.
And what did Blackstone say?
He articulated this principle with real finality, stating that the law of nature is, quote, superior in obligation to any other, and that no human laws are of any validity if contrary to this.
No validity? That's a strong statement.
It is the critical ceiling. Blackstone asserts that human-made law statutes cannot violate the higher, eternal law of nature. If they do, they are not merely bad laws. They are invalid laws. They are non-laws.
Right. And that distinction immediately creates a profound limit on legislative power. It sets up what the source calls the written cage for government agents.
The written cage. I like that.
Which brings us to the purpose of that cage. Rights aren't gifts from the state. They are pre-political endowments. Life, liberty, property. So what is the government's sole legitimate function, according to this framework?
To secure those pre-existing rights. That's it. Thomas Paine observed that rights don't originate in positive enactment, but arise from the very nature of man. The government is just the collective mechanism established to protect them.
The source also uses Frederick Bastiat here.
Yes. Bastiat distilled that understanding into a single axiom, which the source uses heavily. Law is the collective organization of the individual right to lawful defense.
That's a powerful idea. So if government exceeds that charge, if it starts creating rights, or crucially for this topic, if it usurps authority it was never given,
it ceases to be a lawful defender. In the source's view, it becomes an instrument of oppression. This foundational premise that law is about securing pre-existing rights, not creating them, is the bedrock of the entire constitutional indictment against the Federal Reserve.
And this leads directly to the nature of the Constitution itself. The source is very clear on this. It is presented not as a flexible living instrument,
no,
subject to interpretation based on modern necessity or judicial fashion.
It is defined as a fixed written contract of strictly delegated authority. It is binding upon every agent who takes the oath to uphold it.
So we're back to the idea of agency, like hiring a contractor.
Exactly. The people are the sovereign principal. Congress and the executive are merely the limited agents. This perspective relies heavily on Thomas M. Cooley, the great American constitutional scholar.
And Cooley said?
Cooley stated that a written constitution is, in every instance, a limitation upon the powers of government in the hands of agents. It means the agent only has the exact power the principal explicitly gave it. No more, no less. You can't just imply new powers into existence.
Okay, let's formalize this. The source structures this into a four-tiered hierarchy of authority, which is absolutely essential to understand the argument for void ab initio. Walk us through these four levels.
Think of it like a chain of command where legitimacy flows only downward. At the absolute pinnacle, tier one is the law of revelation, or God's law. These are the infinite and unchangeable moral precepts, the ultimate source.
Okay. And tier two, immediately below that, is maybe the most legally intriguing tier for this discussion. The fundamental maxims of law.
Yes. These are cited as eternal and self-evident propositions to be of all men confessed and granted without proof, argument, or discourse. And that's a quote from Sir Edward Coke.
So what are these maxims, practically speaking?
They're the foundational rules of fairness and justice that govern all subsequent contracts, including the Constitution itself. Things like, no man can benefit from his own fraud. Or, and this is key for our topic, that delegated power cannot be redelegated. They are rules of logic applied to justice.
So, if a government act violates one of these maxims, even if it seems to follow the Constitution's text, the source would say it's still fundamentally flawed.
That's the profound claim. Because the third tier, the constitutions of society, our written constitution, is valid only if it kneels to those eternal maxims and the law of revelation. Cooley is cited again, reminding us, the Constitution itself must bow to the higher law.
So the Constitution isn't even the highest law of the land in this framework?
Not in this four-tiered hierarchy, no. It's tier three.
And finally, at the bottom, tier four, we have enactments, statutes and codes.
Right. These are the laws passed by Congress, like the Federal Reserve Act. They are valid only if they bear a valid enactment clause and, crucially, if they are subject always to the higher laws. Statutes are not the ultimate law of the land. They are merely the will of the legislature, which must conform to the constitutional contract.
Okay, so if the Federal Reserve Act is a Tier 4 enactment, and the source argues it violates Tier 3, the Constitution, and Tier 2, the maxims of law, what is the jurisdictional consequence?
The consequence is absolute nullity, void from inception. Any act that violates a higher level in that hierarchy is legally non-existent.
And this isn't just a philosophical argument. The source relies on a specific Supreme Court case.
It does. It relies not on modern interpretations, but on the absolute, unyielding rule stated by the Supreme Court in Norton v. Shelby County back in 1886.
That specific citation seems to be the legal linchpin for the entire indictment. This is where it gets really interesting. What does Norton v. Shelby County explicitly state about unconstitutional acts? And why is that so explosive in the context of the Federal Reserve?
Well, the ruling is totally unequivocal. It says, an unconstitutional act is not a law. It confers no rights. It imposes no duties. It affords no protection. It is, in legal contemplation, as inoperative as though it had never been passed.
As inoperative as though it had never been passed. Wow.
Yeah.
Wait. If that ruling is true, and the source successfully argues the Federal Reserve Act is unconstitutional, doesn't that fundamentally undermine every single action taken by the Fed for the last century? I mean, how do they even address that magnitude of consequence?
That is the core challenge the source presents. It argues that the magnitude of the system's operation does not grant it legality. It doesn't matter how big it is or how long it's been around.
So precedent and practice don't create lawfulness.
Not if the foundation is rotten. If the initial delegation was flawed, if Congress did not have the power to create a central bank and delegate coining authority in the first place, then the act never attained the status of law. It is merely a continuous practice enforced under color of law.
Color of law, meaning it looks like law, it acts like law, but it isn't.
Exactly. So if the Fed Act violated the constitutional contract, it has never legally existed, regardless of how long it has been in operation.
Okay, so the government acting outside the express powers delegated by the Constitution means that act doesn't just get overturned. It was never law to begin with. That premise allows us to move directly to the first major indictment, the specific enumerated power Congress has over money.
When you look at the constitutional framework, the term money has a definition that is far more rigid and much narrower than the Federal Reserve note we carry in our pockets today.
And the source begins by defining money before any statutes were written, rooting it in common law.
Right.
So what was the common law nature of money? What was it designed to be?
Money was understood primarily as a measure of value and a medium of exchange. But critically, it had to be a substance, not just a promise.
A physical thing.
Yes. Sir Edward Coke defined money as the just medium and measure of commutable things, which necessarily presupposes intrinsic value. It excludes mere credit instruments.
So the distinction is between substance and debt. Money possesses value in itself, like a piece of gold or silver. Debt, on the other hand, just represents an obligation to deliver that value at some future time.
That is the crucial legal firewall. The source views confounding debt with substance as a fundamental perversion of the rule of right. When you use a gold coin, the transaction is complete. It's settled.
Final.
Right. But when you use an instrument of credit, the transaction leaves behind a lingering obligation, a debt that must be fulfilled. The books are never truly closed.
And this distinction is why Article 1, Section 8, Clause 5 is so precisely worded. It delegates very specific enumerated powers to Congress related to money, to coin money, regulate the value thereof, and a foreign coin, and fix the standard of weights and measures.
It is precise.
Let's break down the historically settled meaning of these terms, because they are the foundation of the source's constitutional measure.
Absolutely. The first term, to coin, meant to stamp metal into money of a fixed weight and a known purity. It implies a physical metallic process, not printing.
Okay. And money.
The second term, money, referred specifically to gold or silver coin of full weight. It was substantive. You could hold it, weigh it.
It was the thing itself, not a representation of the thing. What about value?
The third term, value, denoted the quantity of pure metal contained in the coin, not some nominal designation or a fluctuating purchasing power dictated by law.
So value was objective, based on weight, not subjective, based on governmental decree.
Precisely. And the last term, to regulate, meant to fix and maintain that objective standard, the weight and fineness ensuring uniformity and preventing debasement.
And the founders were clear on this.
The founding era confirmation is compelling. Thomas Jefferson specified the dollar as a defined quantity of pure silver. James Madison said the power was simply to fabricate money out of metal. This wasn't a power to print or create credit out of thin air. It was a power to certify a physical substance.
And this constitutional definition is further cemented by what the source calls the constitutional kill switch.
Right. Article 1, Section 10.
What does it say?
That section explicitly prohibits the states from making anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts. This demonstrates a deliberate, fixed boundary on what constitutes lawful money in the U.S. system.
And the source argues that this boundary applies by extension to the federal government as well.
Yes, because the federal government was only given the power to coin, not to impose debt as tender.
Okay, now let's apply this strict definition to the current monetary medium, Federal Reserve Notes, or FRNs. Why do the sources argue that FRNs fail the constitutional definition of money?
Because they are debt, not substance.
Yes.
It's that simple. The source points to their statutory definition, which you can find in 12 U.S.C. Section 411. It defines FRNs as obligations of the United States.
An obligation is a liability. It's a debt.
It is. Furthermore, and this is a key accounting insight, on the balance sheets of the Federal Reserve banks themselves, these notes are recorded as liabilities, not as assets.
That's a really powerful point. In a conventional accounting sense, an asset has value. A liability is something you owe. If the Federal Reserve note is a liability on the balance sheet, it is, by its own definition, a debt instrument.
Correct. The conclusion, therefore, is that the system substitutes private bank debt for constitutional coin. It replaces substance with credit. It replaces money, which ends a transaction, with a debt instrument, which just carries a promise.
This is why the source cites the legal maxim from Craig v. Missouri.
Yes, well, on a fraud, always a fraud. Labeling this private debt as legal tender does not cure the underlying constitutional defect of being a substitute for constitutionally defined coin.
This brings us squarely to the non-delegation principle regarding monetary authority. This is where the Federal Reserve itself enters the constitutional firing line. Congress was given the specific exclusive power to coin. How can a private institution like the Fed issue the actual currency?
Well, the source invokes that famous maxim we mentioned earlier, delegata potestas non potest delegari.
A power delegated cannot be further delegated.
Exactly. Monetary sovereignty is one of the most fundamental powers of any state. It affects the entire polity. According to this analysis, it cannot be handed by Congress to a private guild, as the source terms the Federal Reserve.
Let's use the analogy we discussed earlier. If I, the sovereign principal, the people hire Congress, the general contractor, to build a specific type of house.
The constitutional system based on coin.
Right. I gave them the fixed blueprints.
Yes. And that contractor is forbidden from outsourcing the entire structural foundation, the issuance of the money, to a private subcontractor, the Federal Reserve, without your express consent and a contract amendment.
Which would be a constitutional amendment.
Right. If Congress attempts to do so, it acts not as a delegate, but as a usurper, and the act is a nullity. The authority entrusted by the principal must be exercised by the entrusted agent alone.
What's fascinating is how the source brings in state constitutional history to show that this wasn't just a federal quirk.
No, it's not. Even states like Washington, Colorado, Utah, and Idaho, which were adopted long after the founding, still preserved an anti-private issue principle. They often required that nothing but the lawful money of the United States shall be put into circulation as money.
That continuity confirms that the constitutional definition of money, the gold and silver coin standard, remains stable in the constitutional text and the popular mind, even as Congress began moving toward paper debt.
The persistence of that definition proves that the substitution of paper debt instruments for coin was not a lawful constitutional change, but a divergence in practice, a violation.
And since the source is a structural critique, we have to ask, does the rapid evolution of currency into digital forms like proposals for a central bank digital currency, a CBDC, does that cure this constitutional defect?
The source argues unequivocally no. It just obscures the defect further through abstraction.
How so?
Digital monetary instruments, including CBDCs, possess no intrinsic value, nor do they rely on a fixed metallic standard. They are purely abstract claims, maybe an even greater abstraction than paper.
So the format doesn't matter.
Not to the core argument. Whether the medium is paper, electronic entries, or digital tokens, instruments that represent debt rather than constitutionally defined coin fail the test under Article 1, Sections 8 and 10. The shift to digital does not cure the absence of intrinsic value or the violation of that written cage. Analytically, they remain outside the scope of delegated authority.
And are still, in this view, void ab initio.
Yes, that's a powerful warning. If the foundation is debt, the format change doesn't matter. #3.0 delegated authority and the immutable rules of limitation. If the issue of money is the substance, the next structural indictment is about the power itself. It's about the absolute limits of congressional authority.
And the structural principle is non-negotiable here.
Completely. Sovereign power resides exclusively in the people, and government possesses only what is expressly and affirmatively delegated.
This sounds like a simple rule, but it's the legal foundation for restraining power.
It is the entire premise of American government. Delegated power is narrower, it's conditional, and it's governed by immutable rules derived from common law and the law of agency. Violation of any of these rules, the source states, renders the act void from inception and defines the actor as a usurper.
Okay, so we need to detail these five rules because they directly challenge the Federal Reserve's operational framework.
We do.
Let's start with Rule 1, the limited source.
Rule 1 is drawn from Shepherd's Touchstone, and it asserts, a man cannot grant a thing which he hath not. Applying this to the Constitution, the government can only be delegated powers that the people themselves possess.
Give me an example.
If the people, as individuals, do not have the inherent right to compel their neighbors to accept debased currency or to inflate the monetary supply at will, they cannot delegate that power to Congress. This places an initial, intrinsic boundary on the scope of the delegation itself.
Okay, that makes sense. If I don't have the right to take your property, I can't give the government the right to take your property outside of very specific defined parameters.
Right.
Now for Rule 2, the famous no redelegation principle. Potestas delegata non potest delegari. This is the direct challenge to the Fed.
This is the hammer blow against the modern administrative state, according to the source. This rule dictates that the entrusted agent Congress must exercise the authority alone. It cannot transfer its legislative duty to an agency or to a private actor.
Which the source maintains the Federal Reserve System fundamentally is.
Yes. If Congress delegates the power to coin or to regulate its value to a private body, the act of delegation itself is void, because Congress is acting outside its agency. It's breaking the contract.
So this means that if Congress decided the task of minting coins was too complex and they just outsourced it entirely to a private security firm, that act would be jurisdictionally null.
Exactly. The function of exercising sovereignty must remain with the public accountable agent. If the power migrates to a private entity, the source argues, that entity is exercising sovereign power without any delegated constitutional right to do so.
Thus standing as a usurper.
A usurper, yes.
Moving on to Rule 3, no exceeding scope. Delegata potestas non potest excedere fines delegationis.
This rule emphasizes that derivative power, the power the agent has, can never legally surpass the original grant from the principal. The government cannot just invent new powers outside the bounds of the delegation simply because they seem necessary or expedient.
It's all about the contract.
The power given is conditional, and the condition is the contract itself, the Constitution. The creation of a private, unaccountable central bank structure is argued to wildly exceed the simple grant to coin money.
Which brings us to Rule 4, express exclusion. Inclusio unius est exclusio alterius. This is the strict interpretation of the enumerated powers.
This is where the specific language of Article 1, Section 8, Clause 5 becomes so critical again. The inclusion of the power to coin money, defined by metal and weight, is the express exclusion of the power to create and print fiat debt.
The choice of words matters.
Deeply. The founders enumerated specific powers for a reason. Any power not expressly granted, like the power to create perpetual debt instruments, to operate a fractional reserve system, or to establish a central bank structure, was intentionally withheld. Power not in the text has no existence.
And Rule 5, which the source applies most forcefully to the question of a central bank. Constitutional silence is prohibition, or casus omissus.
This rule is pivotal. Thomas M. Cooley's observation is foundational. The silence of the Constitution is prohibition. The absence of delegation is jurisdictional.
So it's not an oversight.
No, it's deliberate. The source emphasizes that the Constitution's total silence on powers like creating a central bank, issuing perpetual debt instruments, or transferring monetary authority to private corporations is deliberate casus omissus. It is not a blank space to be filled in by expediency. It marks the absolute outer boundary of lawful authority. All presumptions are against the government and in favor of the citizens' rights.
So the argument is that because the Constitution doesn't say Congress can create a central bank, it means they cannot. It's a deliberate omission that serves as a boundary.
Precisely. And applying these five rules, the power to coin money is an exclusive power. It affects the entire polity and therefore cannot be exercised piecemeal, privately, or opaquely.
And the consequence of violating these rules is what the source calls the lapsing of authority. Explain that concept of lapsing.
If Congress attempts to transfer this exclusive power to a private entity, it acts outside the constitutional bounds. The power doesn't magically migrate over the Federal Reserve.
It doesn't follow the action.
No. Instead, the authority simply lapses.
Yeah.
It disappears. Congress, the designated constitutional actor, has ceased to act within constitutional bounds, and the resulting vacuum cannot be filled by implication or administrative practice. The Constitution, therefore, remains intact, but the Federal Reserve System operates in a zone of non-delegated authority.
A jurisdictional void.
A jurisdictional void. It persists as a matter of institutional fact, but not as a matter of law. That structural defect, operating through private instrumentalities and resting upon non-enumerated powers, is the basis for the void ab initio claim, regardless of the system's complexity or how long it's been running. This section introduces a highly technical, yet incredibly fundamental critique that often surprises non-lawyers.
And what's that?
The importance of the form of the law. The source argues that lawful power must be exercised through instruments that bear the marks of constitutional legitimacy. As Koch stated, when the form is not observed, it is inferred that the act is annulled.
Why does form matter so much? I mean, isn't it the substance that counts?
It's fundamentally about accountability and notice. The people must be able to identify from the face of the law itself the source and scope of the authority being claimed over them. If that identification is obscured, the source argues, delegated authority dissolves into mere presumption. It forces citizens to simply comply without true lawful consent.
Okay, let's clarify the distinction between law and compilation. Most listeners, when you look up a statute, you're looking at the United States Code, the USC.
Right, but the source makes a crucial distinction between the US Code and the actual enacted law.
Which is?
The Constitution vests legislative powers in Congress. When a bill passes both houses and is signed by the president, it is codified in the statutes at large. That is the law itself. The United States Code is a convenience. It's a post-enactment organizational tool used by lawyers, agencies, and the public.
So is the U.S. Code legally binding?
It depends entirely on how Congress has classified its titles. Mm-hmm. Congress designates titles as either positive law or non-positive law.
Okay.
Positive law titles are themselves legal evidence of the statute. Think of this as the final, ratified, notarized version of a contract. It's the law.
And non-positive law titles?
They are merely prima facie evidence of the law.
Prima facie, so on its face.
On its face, yes. It means they appear to be the law, but that appearance is rebuttable. It can be challenged by going back to the original statutes at large. A non-positive title is more like meeting notes or a draft memo summarizing a contract. If a statute is in a non-positive title and there's a dispute, a litigant must track down the original law and the statutes at large to prove what the law actually is.
That seems like an administrative nightmare, but what is the constitutional relevance here? Where does the statutory framework for the Federal Reserve fall?
It falls squarely in the non-positive law category. Title 12, Banks and Banking, which is the principal codified source for the structure and operation of the Federal Reserve System and most banking regulations. It has never been enacted in the positive law as a unified statutory text.
Wait. So the legal framework defining the Fed is housed in a compilation that is only prima facie evidence of law. It's the equivalent of relying on a draft memo to enforce the regulations of a century-old sovereign entity.
That is the source's indictment. If enforcement is premised on non-positive law compilations, it constitutes jurisdictional usurpation. The source argues that the chain of delegation is broken. The constitutional requirement that power be traceable and visible to the people is violated when the public is forced to rely on organizational guides instead of the duly enacted statute itself.
So it adds a layer of purposeful obscurity?
It does. And the source points to the missing enacting clause as part of this formal defect.
The enacting clause? What's that?
Historically, a valid statute bore an explicit declaration that the law was made by the authorized legislative body pursuant to constitutional authority. Something like, be it enacted by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled. This clause is the anchor. It connects the action of the legislature directly to the authority granted by the Constitution.
And when that language is stripped away in the codified version, the version used by courts and agencies every day, what is the consequence?
The statute's jurisdictional identity is obscured. The people are required to search through historical documents to verify whether a binding law even exists at all. Absent that anchoring clause, the purported statute fails to speak with clarity as to its origin and scope.
And this allows government action to glide into what the source calls
administrative despotism, operating under the pretense of law while resting on instruments that may not constitute law in the strictest constitutional sense.
So the indictment is structurally profound. The Fed is exercising powers that were never delegated, and the legal framework used to enforce these powers relies on instruments that lack constitutional certainty in their form.
That's the argument.
Now let's look at the historical moment of the Act's creation. #TatchTag 5.0, the historical genesis of the Federal Reserve Act, 1913.
To fully grasp the source's constitutional critique, we have to examine the circumstances of the Federal Reserve Act's birth in 1913. The source emphasizes that the legislative history illuminates whether the exercise of legislative power conformed to the structural expectations of Republican governance.
Which are
transparency and public responsibility.
Right. And the idea of a central bank wasn't new. It had been debated and killed multiple times going back to the first and second banks of the United States.
That's critical context. Those early debates establish that the constitutional framework governing money was fixed. No amendment had been passed to expand Congress's authority over currency issuance beyond coining metal.
So the rules hadn't changed.
The rules had not changed. Therefore, the source argues, economic necessity, which was the motivation for the 1913 Act, cannot legally expand a fixed constitutional boundary. The maxim applies. That which is void in the beginning does not become valid by lapse of time.
Okay, so let's detail the secret genesis of the Act. The Jekyll Island meeting in November 1910. This is the stuff of historical intrigue. Who were these participants and why does their secrecy matter constitutionally?
It was an assembly of the most powerful U.S. financial and political interests, operating entirely outside of public scrutiny. The group included Senator Nelson Aldrich, Paul Warburg, a major banking expert, Frank Vanderlip of National City Bank, Henry Davison of J.P. Morgan & Co., Charles Norton, and A. Piet Andrew, a Treasury official.
Talk about a meeting of the elite, a real who's who of money and power. And the secrecy was intentional, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. They traveled under aliases to Jekyll Island, Georgia, specifically to draft the initial legislation in secret. Vanderlip later admitted, with a degree of candor, that this meeting was the actual conception of what eventually became the Federal Reserve System.
So what is the constitutional critique of this secret inception? Why does it matter how it was born?
The source argues that a proposal affecting core sovereign functions, the power over the nation's money supply, was formulated entirely by private, unaccountable actors with vested financial interests. This violates the fundamental principle that the advice of many is requisite in great affairs.
So it's a procedural foul from the very beginning.
And the source labels the genesis itself as administrative despotism. The system was born not from public debate over delegated authority, but from private consensus among those who stood to benefit from the new financial structure.
It sounds like the constitutional problem started before the bill even reached Congress.
It did. The source argues the organized bar associated with these participants then took this private draft and refined it, ensuring its immense technical complexity. And this complexity, according to the source, was deliberate.
Deliberate complexity? Why would that be a constitutional problem? It sounds like they were just being thorough.
Technical intricacy serves to limit meaningful scrutiny. It impairs public comprehension. When the structure of the sovereign money system becomes incomprehensible to the average citizen, accountability is severely weakened.
It's too confusing for anyone to challenge it.
Essentially. This serves to obscure the fundamental maxim that no man ought to be burdened in consequence of another's act, particularly when that act is issuing private debt as public money. The complexity shields the lack of delegation.
And the actual legislative passage was rapid, occurring right before Christmas recess in 1913.
Yes, it was rushed through the House on December 22nd and the Senate on December 23rd. Maximizing the ability of opponents to stall the process and limiting sustained deliberation. This speed, combined with the opaque drafting process, is cited as evidence that the act was designed to evade, rather than invite, constitutional scrutiny.
But despite the speed, there was significant historical dissent captured by the McFadden indictment. We have to detail the formal criticism made by Congressman Louis T. McFadden. He was the chairman of the House Banking and Currency Committee, right?
He was, and McFadden provided dispositive testimony in the early 1930s, calling the Fed one of the most corrupt institutions the world has ever known, which has impoverished and ruined the people of the United States. He alleged that the system served the interests of international financiers rather than the American public.
What is the legal significance of that statement in the context of the void ab initio argument? I mean, it's not just a political rant.
Legally, the source uses this testimony as formal notice to agent.
Notice to agent? What does that mean?
In agency law, once the principal, the people, has been given formal legislative notice by an authoritative agent McFadden as committee chairman, that the subagent, the Fed, is engaged in corruption or usurpation, it strips away any claim of good faith immunity for those who maintain the system thereafter. It establishes a formal legislative acknowledgement of the systemic constitutional overreach.
So it's like putting it on the official record. You can't claim ignorance anymore.
That's the idea. The ultimate analytical significance here is that the act emerged from private initiative and legislative accommodation, not a clear constitutional mandate based on the enumerated power to coin metal. Because the power was never delegated to private bankers, and because constitutional silence is prohibition, the source maintains the act and all instruments issued pursuant to it are a systemic nullity. #Hashtag 6.0. Subsequent departures from constitutional money, 1933-1971. The original defect of 1913 did not stand alone. It was entrenched and magnified by subsequent governmental actions that progressively pushed U.S. money further and further away from the constitutional model of coinage.
So it got worse over time.
These later developments are viewed not as creating new authority, but as illustrating and confirming a larger pattern of constitutional displacement.
The first major step was the 1933 gold measures during the economic crisis. Executive Order 6102 restricted private gold ownership and withdrew gold from circulation. The government claimed necessity.
And the source challenges the nature of that necessity.
Mm.
It claims the emergency was a manufactured liquidity crisis used to force the people into consenting under duress.
Coerced consent.
Yes. The maxim applied here is foundational. Nothing is so contrary to consent as force and fear. if the government creates the emergency and then uses that fear to force citizens to surrender their property, their gold, the resultant surrender is not true legal consent.
So the core constitutional injury wasn't just the seizure of property, but the conceptual shift of what constitutional money even is.
Exactly. Gold, which the Constitution treats as money, was recharacterized by executive and legislative decree as a commodity, just a thing, subject to administrative control. It was redefined based on an external administrative act, not its intrinsic metallic value.
Was there any acknowledgement of this at the time?
We even have House Report 416 from 1933 cited in the source, which admitted that this was done without warrant of law. The government seized the people's substance money and redefined it by decree, confirming the trend of constitutional displacement. This source emphasizes that the government cannot confer a favor which occasions injury and loss to others.
Following this, Congress passed H.J. Res. 192 in 1933, which abrogated gold clauses in all existing and future contracts. This act essentially invalidated Article 1, Section 10 contracts.
Right, which previously ensured that payment could be demanded in gold or silver coin.
So this was a direct, explicit repudiation of the constitutional contract itself.
It was. It compelled citizens to accept irredeemable paper debt as a substitute for coin. The source labels this act void because it is repugnant to the Constitution. Legal tender statutes then abandon the conversion requirement, forcing acceptance of the substitute.
And crucially, the constitutional text Article 1, Sections 8 and 10 was not repealed.
No, it's still there. Constitutional limits were simply bypassed by institutional practice.
And the final act in this progressive displacement occurred in 1971.
That was the formal severance. President Nixon ended the remaining international link between the U.S. dollar and gold, the Bretton Woods system. This completed the transition to a fully fiat monetary system, where value depends entirely on statutory declaration, not metallic substance.
And again, this was achieved through executive order and institutional practice.
Not constitutional amendment.
The source characterizes this entire progression from 1913 through 1971 as a pattern of constitutional displacement.
Displacement occurs when institutional practices diverge fundamentally from the written constitutional form while leaving the text untouched. It's presented as a hallmark of agents in rebellion, where the government, through incremental action and emergency measures, redefines the scope of its authority without seeking the required amendment through popular sovereignty.
Result being?
A monetary regime that operates at an increasing remove from its lawful foundation. Since the power was never granted, it does not exist. And supreme power can dissolve itself, but it cannot authorize its agents to redefine the terms of their own written cage.
It's the difference between officially changing the rules and just ignoring the rules until the ignored practice becomes the accepted reality.
That's a good way to put it. #Shag7.0. The doctrine of void ab initio and analytical consequences.
This brings us back, full circle, to the core analytical tool, void ab initio. Given the history and the defects we've discussed, the debt substitution, the redelegation, the non-positive law status, let's reiterate that critical distinction between an act that is merely invalid and one that is void.
This distinction is everything to the source's argument. An invalid act is an improperly executed action taken pursuant to lawful authority. It might be correctable, curable, you can fix it. A void act, however, is taken without lawful authority altogether. It is legally non-existent. It is uncorrectable. The doctrine asserts that acts undertaken without lawful authority cannot acquire validity through repetition, acquiescence, or institutional acceptance.
So when the Supreme Court in Norton v. Shelby County called an unconstitutional act, quote, as inoperative as though it had never been passed, it was enforcing this voidness principle. Why is the passage of time, a century of operation, irrelevant to curing this want of power?
Because jurisdiction is a condition precedent to the exercise of power.
You have to have the right to act in the first place.
You have to. Jurisdiction must derive from delegation. If the Federal Reserve Act exceeded the enumerated powers or violated the non-delegation rule, the jurisdictional chain is broken at the source back in 1913.
Oh.
The maxim applies strongly here. Things bad or corrupted in principle at the commencement improves not by lapse of time.
So a system born of usurped authority remains a
systemic nullity, even a century later. Time only entrenches the practice, not the legality.
This point preempts the two most common counterarguments against this kind of constitutional critique, the argument from necessity and the argument from long-term usage or acquiescence. Why does the source reject these ideas so completely?
It rejects them because they are appeals to pragmatism, which cannot override constitutional principle. First, acquiescence. The fact that the public has used FRNs for a century cannot validate an act that was void from the outset.
Why not?
Because consent, in constitutional terms, must be expressed through delegation or amendment, not through silence or habituation. And second, necessity cannot create power.
But people always say, in an emergency.
Emergency conditions may justify exercising existing authority, like using military resources, but they cannot generate new authority where none was delegated, like creating a central bank. To appeal to necessity is, in the source's view, to ignore the foundational contract of strictly limited government.
That is a very strong analytical firewall. The structural conclusion here is that the issue isn't about economic performance or stability. It's about the constitutional integrity of the chain of command.
It is entirely structural. If the authority exercised over money departs from the original constitutional delegation, if it involves redelegation to private entities or the substitution of debt for coin, it cannot mature into law through usage. Good faith does not confer power. Complexity does not excuse the absence of power.
So where does that leave us?
The source argues that the entire modern monetary framework rests not on law, but on assumption and institutional habit, operating outside the constitutional structure. It leaves us with a stark warning, drawn from legal philosophy. It has been said, with much truth, where the law ends, tyranny begins.
That sentiment really underscores the gravity of the critique. This is about power and boundaries. Hashtag outro. So what does this all mean? We've explored a profoundly structural indictment of the Federal Reserve System and the modern monetary arrangement, drawn entirely from foundational American legal principles. This analysis rests on three unyielding constitutional pillars. First, the substitution of private bank debt for the intrinsic value of coin, violating the fixed definition of money. Second, the violation of the non-delegation rules, where congressional silence casus omissus should operate as a prohibition against creating a central bank.
Right.
And third, the reliance on non-positive law compilations, obscuring the lawful source and scope of the authority being claimed.
The central contribution of the source is purely analytical, preserving the integrity of constitutional limits.
Right.
It clarifies the distinction between what is administratively practiced, the century of the Fed's operation, and what is lawfully delegated, the strict enumerated power to coin metal.
It's practice versus law.
Exactly. The argument is that the Constitution continues to speak where it spoke, and where it is silent, it continues to withhold power. The challenge presented is massive. How a society deals with this divergence between its established institutional reality, the world that runs on Federal Reserve notes, and its fundamental written law, the contract it claims to uphold.
The source material emphasizes the need for recollection and distinguishing law from practice, authority from assumption. The analysis suggests that constitutional meaning does not change by attrition, and delegated authority does not migrate by habit. Mm. That leaves us with a final provocative thought for you to mull or explore on your own. If our established institutional reality conflicts with our fixed, written constitutional law, and the solution must be restoration, not revolution, as the source calls for, how does a society peacefully reconcile a massive, entrenched system operating as a systemic nullity with the strict, non-negotiable requirements of its founding legal document?